in the injustice of what was happening. And that's what my book talks about different ways that people are collectively helping people who are being criminalized, and by doing so, actually showing that there are other understandings of justice and safety. In Tracy's case, that justice would have been not arresting her in the first place, but rather supporting her during a trauma that is unimaginable to so many of us.
And we're going to continue this discussion after the broadcast and post it at democracynow.org. You're listening to Jocelyn Simonson, law professor at Brooklyn College. Her new book is called Radical Acts of Justice, How Ordinary People Are Dismantling Incarceration. We're also going to continue talking with Tracy McCarter, domestic violence survivor, nurse, and grandmother. She just graduated from Columbia University. I'm Amy Goodman. Tune into Democracy Now! Happy birthday to Paul Powell.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Sound was used for centuries as a method of torture. Place someone's head inside of a bell and ring it.
Tune in to KBOO every other Tuesday at 3 a.m. for the Vinyl Pajama Party with your erstwhile host, Brian.
And eventually, they'll go insane.
You never know what you will find on your radio/interwebs during the show, but it will be something.
They'll go insane. And eventually...
That's the Vinyl Pajama Party, alternating Tuesdays at 3 a.m., only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM.
Good morning and welcome to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO FM, 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis, and via the World Wide Web, it is kboo.fm. We are broadcasting live. Today is the 2nd of October. It is 8 a.m. Pacific Time. I am Cecil Prescott, and I will be joined this morning by my co-host, Celeste Carey. And we welcome all of you this morning, and thank you so much for joining us. This morning, we have the opportunity to speak with a journalist, Yusuf Al-Jamal, and I'm just going to read this blurb, so stop me when I'm not speaking correctly. Recently received his PhD in the Middle Eastern Institute at Sakarya University in Turkey. Yusuf, besides his research interest in the diaspora, security, and indigenous studies, has contributed to a number of books which highlight the Palestinian struggle. He has translated two books on Palestinian prisoners entitled The Prisoner's Diaries, Palestinian Voices from the Israeli Gulag, and Dreaming of Freedom, Palestinian Child Prisoners Speak. He's also co-editor of A Shared Struggle, Stories of Palestinian and Irish Hunger Strikers. He has published numerous articles. He's currently on a book tour of the United States, and he's in Portland today. You're leaving to Olympia and Seattle and places all over. So thank you so much, Yusuf, for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
And also, I forgot to get your whole name.
Yeah, Jennifer Bing. Yeah.
Jennifer Bing with the American Friends Service Committee?
Yeah.
Excellent, excellent. So thank you so much for joining us this morning. And I think I want to begin by asking a very important question, and that is, have you decided whether New York or Chicago pizza is best?
You know, this has been a long debate. And when I go to New York, I try to please my American friends there and tell them the New York pizza is better. When I go to Chicago, I tell people there that the deep dish pizza is the best in the world, so that we, you know, do not start conflicts and try to please everyone, basically. This is what I do. I try to be safe.
Well, you can't be safe because, you know, here in Portland, we've been voted the second best pizza in the world by some Italians. So,
I mean, if it's Italians.
You know, just be true to yourself.
Yeah.
I don't know. One of our pizza places in Chicago just got ranked in the top five. So
yeah, but we're two.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, we're two. So top five still puts them behind us, unless they're one.
Okay.
But, you know.
We won't talk about our sports teams either.
Yeah.
Okay, no.
But, you know, my point being, you know, just be true to you. Yeah. Whatever works for you. And I appreciate the fact that when people come out of environments where there's a lot of strife, that they try to stay true to what they see. You know, and I think that's one of the things that we get when we see the book and the collection of voices, is like trying to stay true to what's actually happening.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about the purpose of your book tour right now, and what are some of the things that you are discovering and hearing, and we can delve more into that a little bit. So about your book tour.
So this is the second portion or phase of the book tour. I was on the East Coast last year when the book was published in August by Haymarket. The book is called Light in Gaza. We've been promoting the book. There are several contributors to the book who wrote chapters about their, you know, life in Gaza, the history of Gaza, travel restrictions, poetry, culture, food, agriculture, and their imagination of how future would look like in Gaza one day, free from occupation, apartheid, and settler colonialism and siege. Gaza has been under siege for almost 16 years now, and it's a very tiny coastal enclave, and there are 2.3 million Palestinians, 70% of them are refugees, including my family. So we are promoting the book with the American Friends Service Committee, today here with Jennifer, who works for the Palestine-Israel Program. And we're trying to reach out to Americans. We've been to Portland State University yesterday, a community center. So we're reaching out to different groups, churches, unions, to tell them about the book and about, you know, our imagination of a free life in Palestine one day. At least the situation now is very disastrous and sad. But this doesn't deprive us of the liberty to imagine a future beyond borders and travel restrictions. I've been impressed by some of the comments, and one of the students who attended my talk 2 days ago, there was a book reading, and she said, "I'm very angry. I didn't know that. I want to read more. These stories are important, but I will read more stories." And I think this is why we are here, and it makes us feel that our work is paying off. Although bringing about change is not easy, it takes decades of work and grassroots organization. But every time I've been visiting the U.S. since 2014, and the first time I was in the U.S., I was also with the Quakers, the American Friends Service Committee in Philadelphia, and I see a change taking place in the U.S. discourse among grassroots, organizations and peoples on the ground, and people are willing to listen to us. Our narrative is now valid, and that's why we are here. Mm-hmm.
I think that's so important. You said in terms of compared to earlier, in terms of the changes in attitudes, and your last point, your narrative is now valid, I think you said. I think there's been such a media blockage in hearing voices of Palestinians. What are some of the things, concerns that you are hearing from Americans now that you may not have heard a few years ago in terms of perhaps recognizing the struggle for liberation, and also, and maybe later Jennifer can talk about it, this move by many organizations to talk about the issues in terms of apartheid and the relationship with apartheid.
In the past, you know, when we talk about Palestine, if Palestine is ever mentioned in the U.S., including in the U.S. mainstream media, we are reduced to a number of, you know, like terrorists and helpless victims. We are statistics. We are, you know, someone in a UN report. But this narrative is changing. People relate to our personal experiences. People now in the U.S. know us and know about artists and writers and poets and figures from Palestine and Gaza. Mus'ab Abu Toha, who is a contributor to Write in Gaza, recently won a National Poetry Award in the U.S. Malak Matar, who designed the book cover, is now touring Hawaii and connecting with the Hawaiian indigenous people, exhibiting her arts. So we are more visible now, and we are connecting with other groups and peoples. As I said, speaking of Hawaii, the Palestinian Hawaiian movement is gaining momentum. Palestinians connect with African Americans, and police brutality and violence and surveillance, because this is what Israel is doing to the Palestinian people. They even try to train some police departments from the U.S., which is really dangerous, and this is the last thing that the U.S. wants and Americans should have. So we have these connections in, like, Black Lives Matter. A lot of Palestinians were participating in the protests, and you find the murals in Gaza of George Floyd, and a lot of people do not know that. And we see ourselves in Malcolm X and the struggle for liberation in this country, and elsewhere. We connect with indigenous people in New Zealand, in Australia, Aboriginals, the Maori people, indigenous groups in South and Central America. We feel we are a part of a growing and, like, global movement for equality, and Palestine is the center of this movement. A lot of people defend Palestine not because they think that, you know, Palestinians are victims, or the issue of Palestine is important than other issues, but because they believe that Palestine became, like, the center of testing the consciousness of the world. What is happening to the Palestinian people is horrible and terrible in many different ways. What happened to my family, and losing family members, and My friends, I mean, my story and what I'm trying to communicate to Americans that what's happening to me and my family is not unique. It's what happening to every single Palestinian. And it's been almost 100 years since British colonization of Palestine. And we're still suffering. Our Nakba catastrophe started in 1948 when Israel was established, but it never stopped. We live Nakba every day, and this is what we're trying to say and tell Americans today in order to bring about change, because Americans are also responsible. Because American tax money is given to Israel annually is being used to oppress the Palestinian people. And that's why we are here, to talk to people, to talk to politicians and students on campuses and churches and unions in order to bring about change and enlighten them about, you know, the implications and consequences of how American tax money is being used to so that Palestinian children are caged by Israel.
You're listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. 90.7 here in the city of Portland, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, Whitestone in Washington, Hood River, Oregon. In the Willamette River Valley, it's 104.3. And everywhere you can hear KBOO at www.kboo.fm. We're here today bringing light, shining light on the book, the anthology, Light in the Gaza. And we're speaking today with Youssef Al-Jamal. Did I get your last name right?
Almost right.
Okay. Al-Jamal. There
yes.
We go. And we are sharing the voices of many of those people who are living in Palestine, feeling the effects of the Israeli apartheid, but still not allowing themselves to be oppressed mentally and spiritually, shining light so that we can see what's going on, but also see their bravery. And we invite calls here a little bit later, but we want to also invite you to support our work. Drop in at www.kboo.fm and click on that beautiful red invitation, donate, and become a member. And you can also do so by texting the letters KBOO to 44321 to help us reach our $55,000 goal. And we will also, this is my add-on, we want to get 5,500 members by the end of the year. You can be a part of that. Give us a join. To get back to our conversation, one of the things that I heard you saying is being able to connect with other groups who are fighting various forms of oppression. And Cecil was asking, you know, how you've seen some differences over the years. And I'm curious with the connection between these groups is how successful do you feel it's been of a global uplifting of your cause? Not just knowing that you're going through this, but bringing pressure to bear so that other voices in other countries are actually making changes on how their countries address Israel.
I think it's been very powerful seeing, for example, Kanaka Maoli, the indigenous people of Hawaii, mm-hmm. raising a Palestinian flag when I was there 4 years ago, and the amount of solidarity and support they felt when they knew that there were Palestinians on Mount Kea, where a company is planning to build a 40-meter telescope mm-hmm. On a mountain that is very sacred to the
yes.
Hawaiian people. I see it with, you know, African-American delegations visiting Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. I also see it with Hawaiians visiting Palestine and Palestinians, you know, visiting Palestine, or visiting Hawaii, sorry, and other delegations from different parts of the world, indigenous people connecting together and seeing the similarities. And it's interesting because...
And supporting each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. At the Great March of Return, which broke out almost 5 years ago in Gaza, and this is not surprising because in Gaza, 70% of people are refugees, as I said, including my family, and there are 8 refugee camps in the coastal enclave. People used similar tactics that indigenous people in the U.S. used to blur, the police and their ability to see them. And Standing Rock, people used mirrors to blur the vision of the police. And this is what Palestinians did at the Great March of Return at Gaza border to blur the vision of Israeli snipers, because Israeli snipers, and it's documented by Israeli media and Israeli human rights organization, they were bragging about like shooting Palestinians in the knee or getting a child, and like it's documenting. There is a video that was leaked. And so Palestinians use, you know, the same tactics. We feel this connection, and you know, it's a struggle for land, and a lot of people who had settler colonial regimes and governments connect with us. Speaking of, you know, shared values and how people can relate to the experience of other people. And that's why, for example, Palestine is a popular cause in Ireland today, because the Irish people can relate to us. And I've worked on a book on Palestinian and Irish hunger strikers, and the similarities are very striking. The Prevention of Terrorism Act was used in Northern Ireland, in Belfast and elsewhere, against the Irish people by the British government. And the British government itself introduced a law called administrative detention in 1936 in Palestine. That was later used by Israel, still used by Israel, where they hold Palestinian political prisoners indefinitely without charge or trial. They would renew their sentence every 6 months. And I know someone who spent 15 years in jail under this law. So we do connect with these, you know, with other struggles, and it's very empowering. We feel like we're not alone in this struggle. We're not exception to history. It happened to other people. So it gives us hope that the same as our brothers and sisters in Ireland were victorious, the Palestinian people will also be victorious.
Yes.
Although the pain and the suffering and the sorrow that we have to endure until we get to that point is too much to bear, but this is, you know, the course of history. And as I said, change is not easy. And we have to talk to people. Even if I win a heart, like one person, this is a big thing for me. And
yes,
one day we will be able to build a movement that will give Palestinians a full liberation and equal rights.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much. When you were speaking in terms of solidarity with different movements around the world, I was thinking about a book by Isabel Wilkerson, Cast, where she talks about how in terms of oppressive regimes sort of like borrow from one another in terms of tactics. And as you were speaking, you reminded me that oppressed people find solidarity in their struggles and find ways in which to support one another. So whether it's in Palestine or the Philippines or Northern Ireland or Hawaii, there's a commonality in struggles. And so I think it's important for communities to connect with one another. And as you make those connections, and are there, what are barriers that you continue to face in terms of getting your message out? In terms of, is there blockage from media? Certainly you're here on community radio station, but, and you speak on college campuses, but broader, how is the message being,
you know,
shared?
Speaking of the U.S. and elsewhere in Europe, mainstream media is not representing the Palestinian people. There have been some changes, but very limited recently, with, for example, the New York Times publishing the images of dozens of Palestinian children killed by Israel in 2021 in May in Gaza. This was not the case like 10 years ago. You wouldn't find it, but it's still not enough.
Right.
What's happening every day, we have Palestinians arrested and tortured and killed in Gaza and the West Bank. So it's like a small portion of what is happening. And again, this is a reflection of the growing solidarity with the Palestinian people on the grassroots level and in the United States. It's also interesting to see how Palestinians have been using and, you know, like pushing for their own narrative on alternative media platforms, having their own blogs and websites and using social media, which is now also censoring the Palestinian content. There was a Al Jazeera documentary recently about how Facebook is collaborating with the Israeli government to censor Palestinian content in Arabic, which is very interesting to watch. But at the same time, we are finding our ways. We, you know, we have our websites, our platforms, our means of communication. We publish books. We write, you know, writing becomes our, like our pen becomes our sword. We see, like, we impacted people. There are people who follow what's happening in Palestine on social media. So social media brought about a lot of change. Now they're trying to suppress Palestinian content because they realize that Palestinians were able to reach out to larger audiences that were not otherwise possible in the past. I remember in 2012, we were tweeting from Gaza and as Israel was attacking, and we using a hashtag Gaza under attack. And there was this television report saying that this is the first war declared on Twitter, but also, you know, lost by Israel on Twitter. And this is, you know, very, very interesting. Also, reaching out to grassroots organizations and peoples on the ground and campuses and students and churches, this is really important, because without winning the hearts of people on the ground, we cannot force politicians who have their own calculations to act
on your behalf, right?
On our behalf, we have to talk to our representatives, because we bring them to government and office, and we need to pressure them and tell them these issues are important for us.
I want to jump back to something you said, and maybe it's because this is community-based media, but what are the media platforms, whether it's social media, print, electronic, or whatever, that purposefully support you? And one of the reasons I'm asking is so people can tap into that and, you know, and know who is supporting you and where they can get the truth of your voices. Are there some you could share with us?
Yeah, so in terms of social media, Twitter is very powerful. A lot of people from Gaza and Palestine use Twitter, and they tweet in different languages, specifically in English.
Surprising, so, with it being now X with Musk.
Yes.
So that you are getting your messages out uncensored,
yes,
at least right now. Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say uncensored.
Okay, relatively,
but people who use Twitter a lot, and it's been like effective, sometimes more effective than other times. Facebook has been very horrible in like censorship of the Palestinian content, so a lot of people are now giving up on Facebook and becoming more commercialized, and people have to pay to reach out to more people. There are websites such as the Electronic Intifada from Chicago and Mondowise. These are American websites that regularly...
Electronic Intifada is one.
Yes, and Mondowise.net. And, you
know, Mondowise, for people who aren't familiar, it's Spanish Mundo, so it's M-U-N-D-O-W-I.
Mondo.
Oh, Mondo. Okay. So M-O-N.
Yeah.
Okay. D-E. D-E. Yep. Oh, Mondowise. Okay. Yes. And you said it's mondawise.net. Net.
Yes.
Okay. So for people listening, write that down. Go ahead.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So I have been publishing with these websites for a while. And also recently, seeing like more people, Palestinians, getting published by mainstream media in the U.S., which is promising. Rifat Al-Ar'ir, one of the contributors to this anthology, who couldn't be here today because of visa restrictions and travel restrictions on Palestinians, published with the New York Times. I know other Palestinians who published with the Washington Post, which was unimaginable a few years ago. So we are making some big breakthroughs, and you know, there are initiatives and like Digital Palestine and other initiatives that try to put Palestine on the map in the like web space.
We're speaking this morning with Yusuf Al-Jamal, a Palestinian writer who is here in the United States on a book tour and also to publicize Palestinians and their struggles. Joining Yusuf is Jennifer with the American Friends Service Committee. And Yusuf mentioned in terms of outreach, and American Friends Service Committee has been very important in terms of outreach to religious community and nonprofit communities. Tell us something about the AFSC and this campaign that you are involved in.
Yeah, thank you. It's wonderful to be here in Portland. So the American Friends Service Committee actually has a real long history with Gaza, going back to 1948, when the Quakers were asked to come in and help with the refugees, the 200,000 Palestinians that were fleeing their homes to Gaza. And that was when the United Nations was an early organization, if you can believe it. So Quakers had some experience doing relief work. So we were there in 1948 and thinking that it would be a temporary measure, that we would, you know, help these refugees, take care of their needs, but also help them to return home. And here we are. How many years later, you know, over 75 years later, still standing with Palestinians in Gaza. We still have staff, Palestinian staff in Gaza, all these many years. We don't do relief work as our sole focus anymore, because we know that this is a political conflict. This is a human-made humanitarian crisis in Gaza. We also have programs in Jerusalem and in Ramallah in the West Bank. But our work here in the United States since the 1970s has been to try to educate more Americans about the realities on the ground. And this book, Light in Gaza, felt like a very specific need to us because of the isolation of Gaza, because people can't make solidarity trips to Gaza. There is a blockade. You can't easily go there. So while we've seen more sympathy and more incredible solidarity created with Palestinians in the West Bank and Jerusalem, you know, in opposition to the separation wall, where apartheid in the communities is very visible, you can't talk about it or see about it when you can't go to Gaza.
Yeah.
So it's felt important to us to bring Palestinian voices from Gaza to Americans to hear their stories. And we started that really after 2014, when our staff in Gaza, after an unimaginable 51 days of assault in July, said, you know, you have to do more. We have to do more as an organization to lift up these voices in Gaza. And we came up with a slogan, Gaza Unlocked, as our website, because we felt like we needed to unlock this isolation, this that separation, and also unlock the hearts of people, of understanding, like, these are not
They're not abstracts. These are human
beings.
They're
not abstract. They've been so demonized in the world, particularly in Gaza, where Islamophobia and all these things that kind of play into this issue. So we were bringing voices to the U.S. From Gaza, and then COVID happened. And we had a speaking tour planned, and we decided, you know what, we're all at home. let's make a book. Let's put out a call to Palestinian writers and ask them to contribute to an anthology, not just to talk about the daily realities, but to, as Yusuf said earlier, imagine what could the future be? What could it be like if the Nakba finally ended, if apartheid fell, if Palestinians could envision their freedom? And so many Palestinians wrote back to us and said, you know, we're never asked that.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's a hard thing to think about when you don't have electricity all day, when you don't have fresh water to drink. You know, the daily survival, so many people in Gaza are just focused on surviving day to day, that to like sit back and say, what could our life look like, be different? And so I think it was challenging for the writers, but I feel like the product is such a beautiful thing that, you know, we were able to work with, I was part of an editorial team here in the U.S. and around the world that worked with these writers, and it really deepened the connection for all of us, so that when our first deadline of May of 2021, that was when the book was supposed to be done, there was another escalation and military assault. We just said, you know what? We have to put this book aside. We have to be in the streets. We have to be pushing the mainstream media. We need to be holding our government officials accountable, which was actually the first time that members of Congress during an assault on Gaza questioned military sales. Now, they didn't stop, but that is progress.
That is progress.
We're starting
to see. It's a change in consciousness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. So the book came out a few months later, and I'm pleased that even the New York Times gave it a good review. You know that, but I think it's just because people didn't expect it. You know, first of all, they don't expect a beautiful cover. People are like, "Oh, look
that
at this cheerful cover," and it's like because Gaza is a cheerful place. People, I've had really the privilege of going to Gaza many times since 1982, before Yusuf was born, until right before COVID. And, you know, every time you go, you see this incredible spirit of people, of their good humor, I don't know if it's the sea or it's the sense of community. But it's also heartbreaking to see these refugees that, you know, our Quaker volunteers in 1950 said their homes are just a few miles away. Why can't they go back? And I think they're still asking that question.
Mm. Why can't they go back? Yeah. We're speaking this morning with Yusuf Al-Jamal, Palestinian writer, and Jennifer with the American Friends Service Committee. They are here this as part of a book tour, and sharing with people about the people in Gaza and the Palestinians, and given voice and opportunities to hear and participate. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. If you have a question or comment for our guests, we will take them. 503-231-8187. Earlier, Yusuf, you were speaking, and almost what I received in passing, you talked about the everyday struggles of your family and people who are close to you. And I don't want us to forget the human aspect of this. And When Jennifer just mentioned Gaza, and it just came to my mind, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people packed in a small...
small area.
Yeah, I was going to say concentration. Well, okay. area, it's hard to imagine for many Americans. Are there things that Americans need to know that you are sharing in with us?
So I grew up in what used to be a British prison during the First World War, and this prison was turned into a refugee community in 1948. My half of my family ended up in the Gaza Strip, and the other half ended up in the West Bank. So we have always like lived with this separation since day one. And it's multi-generational in the sense that my grandparents suffered from travel restrictions, my parents dead, and now it's my generation. And if, you know, this situation doesn't change, you know, the future generations will also go through travel restrictions and separation for years and years and decades sometimes. So the gate out of that prison is the only way in and out of my refugee community. And ironically, in 1942, 1,000 Greek refugees ended up in what became the refugee community, Block A, it's called. They stayed there for a year because the Nazis occupied their island, and they were made refugees in what later became my refugee camp. And today we see thousands of Palestinians trying to migrate to Europe through Greece and Turkey. They take very dangerous, you know, boats and routes, and many of them lost their lives on the way. It's happening as we speak. It's very sad what's happening to the Palestinian people, and Palestinian refugees are made refugees sometimes twice and three times in their lifetime. But again, you know, this is a place that we call home. Gaza is not just a sad place. There are a lot of creative people there. As I said, Malak Matar is exhibiting her artwork in Hawaii as we speak. There are artists. There is a rapper from Gaza called MC Abdul. He's also touring the United States now. We have a lot of IT people, or people who speak different languages, and connecting with American companies and European companies and working online. So people are not giving up. 75 years after Nakba, which is still happening and going every day in Palestine and manifesting in different ways, and Palestinian house demolitions or arrests or killing Palestinians and torturing them, and they're shrinking natural resources. When we talk about Gaza, with 2.3 million Palestinians, 70% of them are refugees. And Gaza's land used to be bigger than that, much bigger than that. The great Gaza area had 34 villages in 1948, and now it's a very small coastal enclave, and the number of refugees is increasing. And many of these people worked their land. They cultivated their land. They were in the agricultural sector, and all of a sudden they had to change their professions after they became refugees in Gaza. But these people, as Jennifer said, many of them live across the border from what used to be their towns and villages, and they cannot go back. And that's why we have the Great March of Return. So it's a call about Palestine. It's not about Gaza only, but Palestinian refugees who are scattered across the globe. That Palestine and Gaza, specifically Gaza, has been very active in the Palestine liberation movement. Many figures visited Gaza in the past, including Malcolm X, Che Guevara, and others. So Gaza has been central to the struggle of the Palestinian people for liberation for decades now. I have a friend, Ahmed El-Hajj, who in 1948, he was 16, he received aid as a refugee from the Quakers. And he's still in Gaza today. He's participating in the Great March of Return. He lives in a rental house. He's well-educated. He was able to push his land and build a new house outside the refugee camp, but he chose not to because for him, Gaza is just a temporary stage in his life. So I want people also to acknowledge the resilience of the Palestinian people. And as Jennifer said, that we have this sense of humor under occupation because if you cannot change your life, what you do? Like, you mock it.
Yes.
You have to, like, entertain yourself. And and unfortunately, Israeli soldiers also tried to entertain themselves by humiliating Palestinians. My dad was stopped one day at the gate of the refugee community, and he was asked to dance in the 80s so that Israeli soldiers would have some fun, and they wanted to humiliate him by asking, forcing him to dance in front of everyone. But he was smarter than them. He asked them to clap because he needed some vibes, you know. And they started clapping. They put their guns aside, and he picked up his slippers and he ran away. And people started laughing at them instead. And he hid at an orange orchard nearby, and he made the so his parents were so worried about him, and he was not able to communicate with them at the time. We didn't have any type of, you know, phones, smart or stupid, anything like that. So he made the call for prayer. He had a very beautiful voice, and he memorizes like poetry and songs. That's how his parents were able to tell that he survived.
They heard him.
So I want people also to, you know, connect with individual Palestinians trying. Literacy rates in Gaza are very high. 98.5% of people are literate. A lot of people learn languages and speak languages and try to because when you live under siege, that's your way, books. And, like, you know, watching films and connecting with other people through the you know, the internet space or books or reading about history and other people and other struggles. And this is what people do. We're not just helpless victims there. We're proud of our identity. As I said, Gaza is one of the oldest cities in the world. 3,500 years. You literally walk on ruins and archaeological discoveries.
On history.
On history, yeah. Just last week, there is a Roman graveyard that was uncovered in Gaza. And there was this grave, and the picture is online. People can find it. There were a couple buried in a grave together, and they were hugging each other. That's like the skeleton you can see. It's very clear. So Gaza is a place of history, and Gaza was also in the past pagan and then Christian, and it had also a Jewish population. Up until 1948, there was a Jewish quarter in Gaza, and a lot of people do not know that. So we are proud of our history, proud of who we are. These days, people harvest their olives in Gaza, and the olive harvest is important in Palestine, especially in Gaza. And people say when it's time for olive harvest, it's like late September, early October, when it rains for the first time in the season, they say, Salla bis-salib, the cross has materialized. Even my mom would say it. My mom grew up in Bethlehem, the West Bank, and she didn't know the meaning. And it has an interesting story which tells, you know, the long history of Gaza. That was, you know, at some point Alexander the Great tried to conquer Gaza three times and he was unsuccessful. Third time he was successful, he lost his leg. So people in Gaza are very rebellious. This is what I'm trying to say.
Well, but not just rebellious. There's a concept that I've been wanting to kind of sneak in there. And help me if my correction, I mean, my pronunciation is that sumud?
Yes.
And that's being steadfast and resilient. And resiliency is not just a response that's barren. Resiliency means you thrive. And I wanted to kind of get you, before we lose the opportunity to talk to you, to give us a little bit of the beautiful colors that are coming out of this book. Because when you talked about the cover, it is a bright, well-lit, like sun-drenched cover, okay? And that kind of light, to play off the title, it gives rise to beauty and growth. And something you said earlier, and it's not just about not being victims, but it's about the ability to create and to be seen not as just victims, but to be seen as not just survivors, but thrivers. And I wanted to have you just mention at least one or two of the voices or the stories, or even what you've put in there, so that people can see that light is not being extinguished. I think it's really important that we hear that.
Yes, so I want to talk about Mus'ab Abu Toha as an example. He won a national award in the U.S. for his poetry. Mm-hmm. And he has written about the cultural scene in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And historically, Gaza has been very active culturally. In the past, there were protests in Gaza in solidarity with peoples in South and Central America. There were donations made by wealthy Gazan families to build hospitals in some Gulf countries. So we have always been there as Palestinians from Gaza, and you know, the cultural scene, poets, Palestinian novelist Ghassan Kanafani lived 1 year in Gaza after 1948 before making it outside Gaza. A lot of important people lived in Gaza throughout history. I was speaking of Alexander the Great, who was trying to conquer Gaza. He couldn't. So we are proud of our cultural heritage. We have a long history. We have a pagan history, Islamic history, Christian history. We have, you know, Jewish history. And people converted over the years. And, you know, we're trying to tell these stories. Even looking at the cover of the book, you see the, like, blue is important in Gaza. Yes. Because of the sea, the Mediterranean Sea. Gaza would be a tourist attraction. Yeah. If this human-made humanitarian crisis comes to an end. We have beautiful, you know, beaches and golden, you know, sand beaches, really beautiful. And this is how we imagine the future. Yes. So when we talk about bright colors, this is the future, the imagination of the future, free from apartheid and settler colonialism. When I talk about my stories and, like, travel restrictions and my mom not being able to see her family in the West Bank because she comes from the West Bank for 12 years just because she changed her address to Gaza, losing her parents on the way, 2003 and 2008, not being able to go. I'm talking about my sister losing her life at the age 26 because she didn't receive the needed medical attention. So these are very heartbreaking stories. Even retelling them is heartbreaking. But again, the reason we are here is because we are hopeful. It's about hope and future, imagining the future. And thus we have these bright colors, you know, that reflect the real picture of Gaza. We're not victims. We are also not heroes. We're human beings. We get frustrated. But we're also very optimistic, and we have a very good sense of humor. We laugh a lot under occupation.
And you have a vision of the future.
Yes, a vision, you know, when we are equal, treated equally, when Gaza is connected with the rest of Palestine. Unfortunately and ironically, I only meet Palestinians from across Palestine in the U.S., not in Gaza. So we are here today so that one day we can meet in Palestine, in Gaza, all Palestinians. So that's why we're very hopeful, and the cover of the book is very hopeful, because we also know from other experiences and struggles, we will be victorious eventually, even if it takes hundreds of years. In Ireland, 800 years, 800 years of settler colonialism, it ended. And, you know, in Palestine, it will end too.
It will end. Mm-hmm. But it's really important that we remember to have a dream of the future. The fact that you still dream in this brilliant color, that you visualize a future of equality and equity in this beautiful color, is important, because one of the key elements of oppression is to rob you of a vision of the future, of vision.
Yes.
You know, so when you speak of light, you know, it's really important for us to to see that your spirits are not broken, that you are still the human beings, resilient and steadfast. So we do have a caller. Good morning.
Good morning to you, Celeste.
Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning to Usef and Jennifer and Cecil. I just want to, there are 2 million prisoners living in Gaza. And if you don't mind, I'd like to have 5 seconds of silence for the 250 dead people shot. So if you don't mind, I'd like to have 5 seconds of silence.
Please do.
Thank you. That's all I need. Check it out. You're Usef. Thank you for your presence. Thank you for being alive, my friend. All right. I'm thinking about Hawaii. Drinking water from both Gaza and Hawaii. From what I understand, the Hawaiians used to be self, like they actually had good drinking water and farmland. But these things are no longer possible.
Okay, Arthur.
Well, thank you, Arthur, for your call and for bringing us bringing that to memory. Did you have a response?
Yeah, I mean, speaking of water, 97% of water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. And a lot of people, a lot of Americans who do not have access to clean water can relate to this. But yes, the situation in Gaza is way more catastrophic. And, you know, land confiscation, we relate to, and our connection to the land is very strong. I was in Hawaii and I see how people have, you know, this strong connection to the land. That land is not a deed, it's not like property, that people could be houseless there, but not homeless. Mm-hmm. This means a lot to me to reflect on, and having all these elements of nature and this connection that we belong to the land, and the land belongs to us. It's not about ownership, but specifically the issue of water is important in Gaza. And you know, imagine with a refugee population who barely can survive, they have to pay to get clean water, and it's getting worse every day, because as I said, the natural resources are very limited and population is increasing by the day.
We only have a couple of minutes, and I want to end what I heard repeatedly over in terms of resilience, in terms of the hope and the future, and as well as the presence. Are there some thoughts you want us to share before you off to Olympia, Jennifer?
Yeah, so one of the things that we're doing in addition to the, like, centering these important voices from Gaza is also to connect with communities to figure out ways that we can be more supportive of Palestinians and to hold our own governments and corporations accountable for continuing the injustice there. And a new initiative that we are a part of is called Apartheid Free Communities. And in that title, Apartheid Free, is also, I think, an aspiration, is that we would like to see, like Yusef said, Palestinians and Israelis living in equality, of having the yoke of apartheid and settler colonialism be something of the past. And what we're doing in the U.S. is to go to communities, to churches, to synagogues, to mosques, to unions, to campuses, etc., and ask them to think about how can they pledge to create more support for Palestinians, and how can we think about accountability in this context. Mm-hmm. So we've got this apartheidfree.org website. If people want to go to that to learn more, there are a few communities already signed on here in Portland. So I encourage your listeners to connect with them and take this important work forward.
Thank you so much. We want to thank you both. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, Youssef, for... Yes.
Thank you for having us.
For your presence, for your writing, for your resilience, and for your inspiration.
Your steadfastness, and you have the permission to narrate. Always yes. Tell your tale.
Yes, this yes. is important. Our narrative belongs to us.
And this narrative belongs to you, the community, KBOO, your community connection. Don't forget to support us. Go to our website, www.kboo.fm. Support us now, and thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is community planted, watered, and grown. Our funding is cultivated by listeners like you. We are looking to harvest $55,000 for this fall drive to support our organic, bountiful programming. Take root by becoming a member today. Just go to kboo.fm/give to donate, or text KBOO to 44321. Thank you.
Here at KBOO, we honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tomwater, Wet'lala Bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin Kalapuya, and many other indigenous tribes and nations of the region of the Willamette River and that great river known as Shwanekku, Wimal, Nisha.